We've been fighting a long time, and we have all lost so very much, so many loved ones gone. But you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. You have no idea how important you are. If you're listening to this, you are the resistance.
Ave Maria.
Welcome, everybody. Steve with Science Vidella coming out with a kind of a book. It's a book review, but it's a historical book review. We've got a historian on the deck right here that you probably haven't heard of before. I'll show you the website, YouTube channel that he has later, but I'm going to butcher it. Groshen, we just got done talking about it.
That's perfect. Groshen. Yeah, it's awesome.
Krasuski. Welcome. How you doing?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm great. He came out with a book published by Kent State University, Confederate Catholics. Now, this is going to be one of those probably somebody's going to get triggered, I think. But I think it was one of the coolest books I've ever read on the Civil War. So we call it Lincoln's War of Aggression, Northern Aggression down here. But anyway, thank you for putting this together. First off, what made you even want to do this book, and how'd you come about doing it?
Okay, so yeah, I actually remember like the whole genesis of this pretty well. I did all my graduate work at Mississippi State. I got my master's degree there and my PhD as well. I'm originally from Pennsylvania. Always interested in the Civil War, but I thought because of my Polish background, I was like, well, I think I'm going to do a dissertation on John Paul II. I think I'm going to write about his first trip to America, which was 1979. I had done a kind of small paper about that, got it published, and I thought that'd be a good kind of springboard to do something with that. And I'm talking to my advisor, and she is a religious historian. Her name is Allison Green. And she was saying, you know, what about, it kind of just like we're having conversations, what about this topic? One thing led to another. And I think I eventually just kind of said, like, well, we're in the South, we're in Mississippi, I am Catholic. I've always loved the Civil War. What if we amalgamate those three things and say, you know, do something about Catholics in the South during the Civil War? And one of the early, really good things, the first person I want to give a huge shout out to is this guy named David Nolan. In 2012, David Nolan is a librarian archivist at Mississippi State. And once I decided with Dr. Green that, oh, I think I'm going to want to go down this road, researching Catholics in the South, David is the one who kind of opened up the floodgates. He was like, there's a bunch of stuff to look at. The first real great primary source was this diary of William Henry Elder. He was the Bishop of Natchez, Mississippi during the Civil War. And once David led me to those sources, you start going to different archives. I was able to go to Charleston, go to Notre Dame. And it just kind of got stitched together. There actually was a lot of stuff. A lot of it was kind of like disparate parts you had to put together. But once I started going through the process, it seemed to kind of snowball in a good way.
Yeah, I saw that. I smiled when I saw that you went down to Charleston. I lived there for 2-3 years. Loved the city. I mean,
we were there and like, yeah, we were just there for 2 days. It was unbelievable. Got to go out to Fort Sumner and go on Folly Beach and just, mm-hmm. you know, Little Row, all that kind of stuff. Charleston's insane. Charleston, I read an article recently where someone was talking about Charleston is the most desirable city to live in all of America and retire and all this kind of stuff. I've been there 2 days in my life, and it was just unbelievable impression. It's so beautiful.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They still have a rule that you can't have buildings bigger than the steeples. It was the cobblestone roads that you could barely get cars down. And you ever been to Stella Maris, where they say that was built from the remnants of Fort Moultrie? Mm. Yeah. Literally right across the street from there is the fort, and it's just they say it came from all the bombardment.
Exactly. No. And that's amazing. I mean, I think that's a whole feature kind of the East Coast in general, too. I had family down in the Tidewater, Virginia area as well. And I mean, everything there, you know, it was just kind of like, you know, old America. And like you were saying, it's still preserved in this really good way. Like, isn't that the great tragedy of kind of, you know, post-war America with the highway system and all that, and travel becomes much more, you know, quick and kind of convenient. We get all these kind of like, you know, grid cities and all that, and these old historical places in the East when they're preserved. I mean, it really is preserving that history for the new generation of people.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was always the horse and buggies down there. We were there at the, when they filmed the movie The Patriot. So if anybody's familiar with that movie, the scene when they're signing to go to war, that was filmed on College of Charleston's campus, the Quad. It took about 5 months to put the streetlights back up.
Patriots, Mel Gibson, right?
Yes, yes. That was supposed to be filmed in the last scene, supposed to be the Battle of Cowpens, but they were not allowed to use the Cowpens battlefield, so they filmed it in Rock Hill, I think it was. But yeah, I'm in Charlotte where the Hornets are, and people, if you don't know the why they're called the Hornets, because Colonel, what's his face, Tarleton, ran into a hornet's nest and it took out a bunch of the troops, so they named the basketball team after the Hornets. Anyways, fast forward to the second quote-unquote American Revolution. All right, people have no clue about that. I didn't know about all this. I've read books by shows by Brian McClanahan. I know about the Abbeville Institute and watched all their shows. They talk about, usually they talk about different topics. And there's a bunch of Catholics that are in both in the Abbeville Institute. And I think Brian McClanahan is a Catholic too, but he usually doesn't push the faith in it. This, I was like, wow. I was literally shooting photos and sending it almost every page to friends of mine going, check this out. I mean, just the first chapter, I was blown away with going, all right, forget about going to high school or college. You're never learning. You're never going to learn stuff like this before. How, when you were, just the first chapter, were you like a jaw drop on that? Like, wow. I mean,
yeah. So I think like I said, I've loved the Civil War my whole life. Some of my earliest memories, I'm from Pennsylvania. And so going to the Battle of Gettysburg, the Gettysburg Battlefield, which is about 3 hours south of where I grew up, and the famous 1993 movie Gettysburg with Martin Sheen as lead, and Jeff Daniels, actually from Dumb and Dumber, playing Colonel Joshua Chamberlain. It's a fantastic movie. And I always just really enjoyed the Civil War. But there was always this kind of stereotype that, well, the Civil War has this one kind of narrative arc, and the main player, of course, is Abraham Lincoln. And the idea with Catholics, right, it's kind of like, well, Catholics are all Irishmen who came over from the potato famine in the 1840s, 50s. Catholicism is a northern phenomenon, and the South is the Bible Belt, and they just hated Catholics and all that. And they, right, like right early in my research, it was amazing to see that, number one, Catholicism was kind of an indigenous religion in the South. It was, you know, actually older than the Catholicism in the North, because a lot of the northern urban centers are potato famine, you know, German and Irish immigration, 19th century, whereas the South, you have like the Spanish and the French, right, in the Gulf Coast, Florida, all that. So Catholicism, number one, is older in the South. And number two, there was a lot of kind of cooperation between Protestants and Catholics in the South. The whole idea of like convents being burned and know-nothing riots and anti-Catholic stuff, it's almost, not exclusively, but often dominantly a northern phenomenon, where in the South, it was kind of like Catholics, despite it being correctly, yeah, it is the Bible Belt. Catholics were often a small minority. They seemed to kind of integrate well into society. That was the jaw drop moment for me. It was like, wow, like I never learned this. I've been a Catholic all my life. I've liked the Civil War all my life. I had no idea there's any kind of Catholic story to the Civil War. So that, yeah, that was, I had the same kind of like initial reaction.
There's a, right out in the first chapter, page 7, the Diocese of Charleston, Bishop Lynch gleefully declared, quote, after years of patient endurance of energetic yet friendly protest and remonstrance, South Carolina has at last, in solemn convention of her people, resumed the portion of her sovereignty, which she surrendered in 1789, and now stands before the world a free, independent, sovereign state. South Carolina is henceforth not only our mother, but our only sovereign, who has sole right to our allegiance. The whole undivided loyalty of our heart and conscience, we speak not only as a Carolinian, but as a Catholic theologian, must be hers and hers only. May the God of peace guide her counsels and bless her with ever-growing prosperity. May the Lord of hosts shield her, if need be, and bless with victory her arms, if they must be used to maintain her honor and her independence as a sovereign commonwealth. Again, that was in the Catholic miscellany, which is still produced to this day in the Diocese of Charleston. I high-fived the ghost that was sitting next to me because there's nobody next to me. And I was like, dude, a buddy of mine, Jonathan Arrington, another South Carolina, I go, you got to read this. That was, I mean, I'd never heard that when I was in, when I lived in South Carolina for 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of my favorite parts of being a historian is that it demands you to do real deep dives, right? You know, I, like anyone else, very much enjoy, if I'm completely ignorant of a topic, doing the Wikipedia search or Google or just finding something on YouTube, but you realize pretty quickly how superficial that is, right? Or how it's just kind of the one narrative. I think the greatest joy of being a historian is really uncovering something new, is exactly like that. It's, well, finding this stuff often requires going to an archive. You have to have, I'm so indebted to the archivists. There's a guy, Brian Fahey, who's the guy at Diocese of Charleston. He's still maybe there. He may not be. This is 2015. It's been almost 10 years. But Brian, when I went to Charleston, was extraordinarily helpful because I just give him kind of my topic, right? My idea. And he's the one who curates it, like a museum curator, picks out the stuff and check these boxes and don't worry about this. Here's the good stuff. Just like that guy, David Nolan, who kind of got the whole thing started. So I think, yeah, like when you're saying you never heard about it, me too, all of us, because I think until a historian does the due diligence to really go and find this stuff and bring it to light and put it into a kind of cohesive narrative, you're just not going to learn it. And I don't even think it's anything like, oh, people don't want to know the whole story. I think human beings in general, and I'm, number one on the list, are lazy, right? It's kind of just like, well, what was the Civil War about? That's this one thing. What was World War II? These two things, don't worry about them. We're always looking for like a soundbite culture, and it's become worse with like Twitter and whatever. Just give me the quick answer. But I think to find this stuff, it's not that it's so buried as much as just it requires a little bit more research than normal. And that's been the most fun part of me, for me, about being a historian, is going on these kind of quests, finding the stuff, putting it together, and then you get to write the book. That's super fun.
I mean, you brought up the parts about the conference being burnt and things like that. I have a book right here, but it's in the other room. It's on the history of Catholicism in Georgia and the Carolinas. And the guy wrote it 15 minutes away at Belmont Abbey. There's a bush underneath the crucifix, and he's literally underneath the bush. They won't cut it back for some reason. Anyway, he writes about the first burnt building was the Ursuline Nuns in Columbia, South Carolina. And they got a warning from somebody, and they proceeded into the gravesite behind a crucifix and hid in the cemetery until it stopped burning. This number two was the prisons, because that's where masses were being offered. And until I read that, it didn't make any sense. Like, okay, why is that? And your book actually comes up with quotes from the Memphis paper, the Idaho paper, obviously Virginia, I think, was another one, Maryland, that they considered the war on the South as a way to exterminate Catholicism.
Yeah. And so, I mean, like, I know it's always so hard to kind of impugn a collective guilt, like all these Yankees were just trying to like stamp out the Catholics. And I wouldn't stand behind that argument in totality, but yeah, there are parts there where it seems pretty obvious. There's some Union generals who are saying like, yeah, go ransack this church, these stupid papists, they're not getting on board with the Union project. I mean, a big comparison, as later in the book, I talk about diplomacy and Pope St. Pius IX. Mm-hmm. There's a huge kind of symbiosis or similarity between the way in which Pius IX, at least on his idea, Pius IX framed his resistance to Mazzini and Garibaldi and these guys trying to create this secular Italy away from taking land away from the Papal States, to the way that, the kind of the more modernizing, progressive policies of Lincoln as he saw them. And even if that analysis wasn't perfectly correct or perfectly applicable always, I think there is some kind of narrative there of like the South fashioned itself, fair or not, as the kind of traditional part of the country, this Jeffersonian ideal. And the North was the one that was trying to rupture away from the, quote unquote, true America and create this new kind of progressive utopian project that you associate with people like Garibaldi and all that. And so yeah, they're definitely, I'm not saying, every single Union general, I think General Rosecrans, a Union general, if I remember correctly, was an extraordinarily devout Catholic. There's lots of anecdotes of him, deep piety, kneeling in the open field for mass. And like, of course, right, there's devout Catholics and lapsed Catholics and atheists everywhere, right? But I think you're right. Yeah, that factors in the book a large part of the undercurrent, because some of those people thought that way. Some of the Union soldiers were like, we want to get rid of everything in the South, every vestige of traditional stuff. And these, you know, these Catholics, especially if they're so ungrateful, they came over to this promised land, the North, and they're going to fight against Lincoln, you know, burn their churches kind of stuff. That was a part of it. Yeah.
Would I be correct to say that that kind of mindset also was part of the U.S.-Mexico War, when you have the San Patricios, the St. Patrick's Battalion, and you hear about the story of them getting pretty much forced Protestantism on them and hated on? The Irishmen of that group was hated on by the U.S. Army at that time, and then before they defected down to Mexico. I guess that kind of makes it, if the same vibe was going on then, why wouldn't it be going on at that time too?
Totally. Yeah. You even like look back to what was going on in Texas in the 1830s. And it's like, you know, Tejas y Coahuila are these Mexican provinces that Texas doesn't gain independence, right, until, you know, 1836. And the whole thing, you know, Santa Ana and San Jacinto and, of course, the Alamo and all that. Texas is independent from 36 to 45. And then in the wake of that 46 to 48, you have the Mexican American War, after which Texas will become part of the U.S. That Catholic Protestant thing is super present in Texas in the 1830s and 40s. It's like when these guys come down, a lot of them are like the prototypical kind of WASP Puritan guy, not just the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but especially kind of the Puritanical Calvinist Massachusetts Bay Colony mindset. They're also looking at people that are in Mexico as, well, we're against them because they're Catholics, right? Like that's also the problem. Like the way America is going to move forward is in this Massachusetts Bay pilgrim type model. And so they're definitely, I don't want to call it a religious war. This isn't like the 16th century, you know, French wars of religion, mm-hmm. where it's kind of openly, the open rubric is Catholics versus Protestants, right? The troubles in Ireland in the 20th century. I'm not saying it's to that pitch. But I think you're absolutely right. There is an undercurrent of that Catholics versus Protestants that, like you said, totally correctly, spills over into questions of the Civil War and all that. Yeah.
And as you brought up before, the know-nothings, that's why the Philadelphia Cathedral's got the windows way up top, because it's harder to break the glass up there. And John Hughes, John telling him.
Yeah. One of the funniest stories I ever heard was Pope Pius IX dedicates something, sends a gift somehow to the U.S. government, and it escapes me the exact details, but he sends something as a goodwill gesture, right? You know, here I'm the Pope, and you know, God bless you guys. That kind of simple, whatever. You know, good job, America. It's very kind of innocuous. And these know-nothing guys steal it and throw it in the Potomac River.
If I'm not correct, I think it's the Washington Monument.
But yeah, exactly, like a foundation stone. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Thank you. Right. So, I mean, that sums it up perfectly, right? We don't want our country, especially D.C., to be tainted by these awful Catholics. You know, so they're down. And I'm laughing now because, you know, thank God, in a lot of ways, the Catholic versus Protestant stuff in America often does have this humorous, hey, we're all Christians, we're all on the same side. I don't mean to belittle how fever pitched this has been in the past. Maybe it is kind of humorous now, but that perfectly encapsulates some of the undercurrent attitudes present in the North, like just no popery, no matter what, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas in the South, it's not so much that, often seen as like, this is the Bible Belt. This is absolutely, you know, Methodist and Baptist country, sola scriptura. But the Catholics, they're like, they're my neighbor. They're not the other enemy kind of thing.
We'll get the elephant in the room out of the way before we go on to some other cool topics. But yes, there was slavery, there was racism in the time. Pretty sure, kind of just like in the idea of German theory, is the entire culture from the South to the North, people were racist. There was slave trade in the North. The flagship, the flag that flew over the slave trade was in the North, and it was the U.S. flag. It wasn't just the stars and bars, as people want to say. People up North didn't want to live where they still, as Alexis de Tocqueville talked about, the people in the South lived in harmony, just the laws weren't on their side. And up North, there's segregated. Even to this day, I remember going to Cincinnati. It's very segregated in different cities up in the North. Pittsburgh, I heard the same way. I think the Tocqueville talked about that. So, yes, if anybody says anything about slavery, that was a culture all over the land, right?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, I'm a, you know, I'm a 21st century man. You know, I was born in 1987, and slavery is heartbreaking. Slavery is evil. Slavery is, you know, unequivocally unacceptable. And that was absolutely the kind of the hardest part of this book, reading some of the Catholic defenses of slavery. That was awful. Like Bishop Augustine Varro, in one point, I mentioned that in the first chapter, he talks about, you know, our main enemy is sin. And yet he, you know, writes this tract in defense of slavery. It's very, very sad. It's like, man, you know, go full Catholic, right? Go full Catholic. Christ is Lord. There's no distinction and everything. Now, that being said, right, amen, that slavery is unacceptable, evil, period. Yeah, it wasn't just the Southern thing. There was slavery all throughout the country. And sadly, when you read Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, he issues it in September of 1862. He issues it in the wake of the Battle of Antietam, as the North calls it, or Sharpsburg, as the South calls it. And he issues it September 22nd, 1862, effective New Year's Day of 63. And the proclamation says, all slaves in the rebelling states are henceforth free. And then the press rips him. And they basically say, hey, man, this seems pretty hypocritical. Now, I'm not saying Lincoln would define himself as a civil rights crusader at all, but they basically say, hey, if you're a civil rights crusader, why don't you just say, you know, all slaves are free because slavery is evil. We're all brothers in Christ. It seems like you're issuing this not for humanitarian reasons, but because you want to, you know, create like another like an uprising in the South. You talk about like the famous slave revolts in the South, you know, Nat Turner, 1831, of course. Haiti in 1791 in the subsequent 13-year war. And so the idea that slavery was only a Southern thing, no, I mean, it was kind of like, it was a sinful, awful behavior all throughout the country. And I'm not trying to rip Abraham Lincoln and say, oh, he's a bad guy, he's a terrible guy. Going back to what I, you know, earlier said, I am a man of the late 20th century, 21st century person. I can't put my lens on those people, right? You can't like, you know, study someone from 300 BC and be like, why didn't they do this? As if in 300 BC, they're going to be thinking like 2023, right? You have to, as a historian, you have to say, what do those people think at that time? It's absolutely true that sadly, it's been kind of mythologized in the way the Civil War is taught, is that the South supported slavery, which is true, which is awful, which is terrible, but the North didn't. The North was not racist. The North was great. They were all for freedom. No, the North was just as racist as the South. The North often liked slavery just as much, sadly. And then in this Emancipation Proclamation, like I just said, the London Spectator basically says, okay, so Lincoln is telling people, if you're loyal to the North, you can do slavery. You can have slaves because it only applies to people in the rebelling states. So is it really a humanitarian thing? So I think you're exactly right. At this time, both sides are sadly kind of, you know, on board with this. And credit to the Vatican, though, and I write about this again in the last chapter, when the bishop that you mentioned, Patrick Lynch, Bishop Lynch of Charleston, when he goes over to the Vatican looking for papal support, at that time, Jefferson Davis's government and the whole Confederacy is fully on board with like, let's get the Pope to help us. Pius IX, to his credit, as Vicar of Christ says, I can't support you guys officially because of slavery. I can't stand behind this. He says basically like, you know, I'm with you. I think that a lot of things in the South are better than the kind of progressive, maybe like, you know, atheist adjacent, you know, I look at the North and I see kind of Garibaldi and I'm against those guys. I'm against these revolutionaries, but you guys support slavery. That's awful. I can't fully support you. So credit to the Pope, even at that time, 19th century, can't put our 2023 lens on it. He's very kind of like, I would say very much as the Vicar of Christ should be, that he's very much for, you know, we should not be supporting practices all of us know are bad. And I'm open in that declaration. When he's talking to these Confederate diplomats, he's not kind of hemming and hawing. He's basically clearly saying, he's like, I have no problem telling you guys. Another thing that we don't learn in our kind of normal education, right? The Vatican liked the Confederacy, did not like the North at all. So he has no problem telling them like, yeah, I support the Confederacy. I want you guys to win. I don't like the North, but even if it is hypocritical, now that Lincoln's issued this Emancipation Proclamation, they're making the war about them being the North against slavery, and you guys are for it. I can't support you guys. So
it was a political move, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because beforehand, I think he didn't care. I think his quote was, who I don't care about this. I don't care about slavery one way or another. He just wanted to keep the Union intact.
Well, a lot, so Abraham Lincoln, and again, I do not want to get on a train of like bashing Lincoln in terms of like.
Right.
No. What I'm saying is, like, if people want to do that, go for it. Like, I'm, you know, do whatever you want. I'm not saying like, oh, nobody better be bashing Lincoln. Like, if you want to bash Lincoln, go for it. You know, bash him all day long. I'm just saying, you know, me personally, that I don't look at Lincoln and think like, oh, this is bad or whatever. I think in many ways he was a very heroic figure. His record on slavery is not what it's presented in like the Daniel Day-Lewis movie of him.
Yeah,
he's just a great champion. He's basically like, you know, he's a civil rights leader. Abraham Lincoln, I believe, in the late 1850s said that he thought slavery would be a reality in America until 1958, for 100 years. He's like, can't do anything about it. In his first inaugural, I encourage whoever watches this video, go read Lincoln's first inaugural address. Back then, the presidents were inaugurated in March, not in January. March 4th, 1861. And he talks about basically like, I'm not trying to end slavery in the South. He's like, you guys can do that. I don't care. Whatever. Kind of each to their own. So he's very kind of like libertarian, as we say today, on slavery. And most damning from the historical record to Lincoln being the great emancipator is twice he shoots down emancipation proclamations. General Hunter and General Fremont, two of his subordinates, in the earlier part of the war, before he does the emancipation proclamation, they tell him like, hey, why don't you issue an emancipation proclamation? Well, why don't you say, you know, we're not going to have slavery? And Lincoln both times says no. And that's kind of not my deal, right? We're fighting just to preserve the Union. So the people that want to say, you know, slavery is the most important question in the Civil War, I do not disagree with that. Of course, it's right there at the top, but it's not the only issue. That's the problem with kind of like Twitter history, right? It's like, that was the only issue. Like the North, when they start off fighting, it's only about preserving the Union, actually. And it's not until Lincoln decides to issue the Emancipation Proclamation that it takes on kind of a new meaning.
Yeah, my first time I saw that was the Politically Incorrect Guide to the South and the Politically Incorrect Guide to the Civil War in the PIG series, which is a great series, I thought. And on top of that, I think there was Northern states that didn't go free to slaves till like years after the EP anyways. Get to the, what was the bishop that said that he wasn't like defending slavery, but he was calling out the Protestants for splitting marriages up, splitting the slave marriages up, mistreating them. And he was pretty much saying, you have to treat these guys well. You cannot break families up. You have to take care of the medical and food and things like that.
Yeah, this is Augustine Varro. He was a bishop in Florida. And to Varro's credit, like I said, when I'm reading his stuff, it's heartbreaking. You know, when he's defending slavery, and it's like, why as a Catholic can you not see past this? The way like Pius IX did, to his credit. But to Varro's credit, when the war ends, I mean, is this not the whole idea of like, you know, repentance, you know, and turning away? Varro, when the war ends, is like, okay, well, the war's over and now everyone's free. So I'm going to work for equality. Like he kind of says, you know, I'm going to go all in and making sure everyone is, you know, kind of an equal citizen. Varro is writing a tract in January of 61, which on the one hand is defending slavery, but on the other hand is saying that here are all the kind of inalienable rights that people even in bondage have, which again makes it even more heartbreaking, is that he's like, he's recognizing the humanity. He's looking at enslaved people and saying, well, that's my brother and sister in Christ. And yet he's not willing to kind of go all the way, which to me, that was the whole kind of Confederatization thesis of my book, is that Catholics were not outsiders. Catholics were not like papists hanging out, fighting the Protestants on the side. Catholics were like rabid Confederates. They were like all in on the Confederacy. So even someone like Varro, who's saying like, who's chastising these Southern slave owners and saying, stop, you know, going all the way to the ultimate awful spectrum on the human rights abuses and stuff, and respect everyone's inalienable, you know, right of being made in the image and likeness of God and not splitting up families. He doesn't say, none of the Southern bishops go outright against slavery or whatever, because they're all devout kind of Confederates. You know, they're putting their faith first, but they're very, very, very much involved in the kind of social fabric of the South. And kind of how you started the conversation, that was one of the most eye-opening things for me, is that I was always taught that Catholics, North, South, East, West, wherever, are always kind of like peripheral citizens, you know? They're always kind of like afterthoughts or whatever. And it's like when you look at the doings of the South, Catholics are like front and center in so many things, like secession conventions in Louisiana, which of course Louisiana is a super Catholic state, obviously, and it even was back then. But Louisiana, it's like, okay, we're having a secession convention. This is a political thing for the now, you know, country of Louisiana, which is going to be a member state of the kind of CSA conglomerate. How should we kick off these proceedings? Ah, you know, get a Catholic priest to lead the prayer. This is, Catholics are very much at the very center of these kind of questions.
Going into the war itself and the clerics that were involved in, like, in that, there were some might have, I think they said some were shooting, but they weren't supposed to. But the masses, they had masses all the time. And you saw, you were right, saying the Protestants were even going to them, masses in the snow, in the fields. There was a lot of edifying remarks about the, I think one priest was talking about the best fighters were the fervent Catholics and the worst were the lukewarmers.
Right, right. Oh, totally. So like, and the priest you mentioned is one of the main characters in the book. His name was Father John Bannon. And Bannon was an Irishman and very much often united the Irish cause to escape dominance by Britain with what the South was trying to do against their King George III of Abraham Lincoln. And Bannon, yeah, Bannon, like, he's manning the cannons often, he's firing guns, which, once more, again, not to be a broken record, but is evidence of, like, here is a man of the cloth who is forbidden from fighting weapons. He loves the South so much, he wants to be such a part of it. He's like, I'll do the cannon, I'll fire the cannon, you know, I'll swab the cannon down. But the vast majority of the priests, especially on the, this is chapter two, I dedicate back-to-back chapters to chaplains. One chapter is about their kind of Catholicity and simply the dispensation of the sacraments, their kind of the ministerial work. And the other part is more their political confederatization, their kind of political involvement. Mm-hmm. Chaplains are edifying, I couldn't agree more, really beautiful stories of, like, the best microcosm could be, here is this chaplain, like Bannon, who's firing a cannon, who's like down with the Yankees, you know, down with Lincoln, and he's just fully involved, basically becoming a kind of Confederate soldier on the make. And not only is he brave on the front lines participating in battle, once the war is over and perhaps people are falling back in retreat, the priests are going out to the wounded and they're ministering to the North and the South indiscriminately. And there's a couple times in the book where someone goes to a Catholic priest, hey, why are you helping this Union guy? He's our enemy. And the priest will beautifully say, like, there are no enemies once the firing stops. This is a child of God. I'm giving him last rites. I'm only worried about saving his soul. You know, I'm giving him all the spiritual helps he needs. So the priests, by and large, were, yes, number one, like all these Catholics, very involved in the Confederate cause. But a beautiful, like, you know, render to God what is God's and Caesar what is Caesar's. After Caesar's due had been rendered, the battle's over. They're only about, you know, saving souls.
Yeah, there's a couple accounts of one of them running back and forth, just getting anybody that's on the ground, baptizing, giving them last rites.
Yeah,
all the baptism. One priest talked about that it was the best conversions he ever had was because these guys were dying in the hospitals or the field hospitals, and he's asking them about, and they're asking him about faith, and he's giving deathbed baptisms, things like that. There were some really cool little stories in there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to bring up there's another priest that went to, the Williamsburg, and he steps in, talks about the Catholicity of these guys, that they were upset that there was too many, there's Protestant, they didn't like Protestantism. And then he goes into Williamsburg and says he's the first person with the true faith to step in this city. And he meets this lady who was a Protestant, but goes up and says, I believe in the community of saints and forgive the confession and things. He goes, well, what's stopping you? Better convert to get out of that nonsense or something like that.
Yeah, no, it's hilarious. I'm glad that both of us were, like, you know, it's like mirthful laughing because it's hilarious. It's so funny because it's so beautiful in that if you read the interactions on the human level between the priests, you know, they're always interacting with Protestants. Of course they are. Again, Catholics are super involved in this, but they are a minority. The majority of the soldiers are certainly of different Protestant denominations. On a human level, these guys are great friends, and there really is some beautiful kind of brotherly love in the camp and all that kind of stuff. But what's so funny is these guys have no problem telling them, like, no, that's wrong. You know, like, you guys are wrong about everything. And I think there's something very refreshing, kind of like, you know, let your yes mean yes, your no mean no. There's not this kind of, oh, you know, obfuscation, I don't know, and you guys, well, it depends. Oh, it's kind of like lukewarm, milk-toasted relativism and stuff. These guys are just like, no, this is the truth. You guys are wrong. You know, convert now kind of stuff. And I think that that's beautiful in a sense, because then, like, everyone knows where they stand. Like, if I always think, you know, if I'm talking to people of different faiths or whatever, talking to an atheist, I have no problem with that person saying that I think I'm right and you're wrong, because I'm going to respond to them, no, I think I'm right and you're wrong. Well, now we can be friends. Now we can have an honest discussion, because each of us knows where we stand, right? This is why I think I'm right. This is why you think you're right. Let's debate. But in our modern society, our postmodern society, it's all kind of like, oh, I don't know. Everything is kind of like whatever. And then you never get any kind of clarity, because it's just kind of, and these guys were very, very clear. And it's so funny at times. Yeah. Like, there's a soldier, Henry Garadal. He's from Louisiana. He's exiled in Virginia. And he's like walking around Richmond, and he at one point prays the rosary, and he says something like, and he's being dead serious. He's like, I was happy that in honoring this devotion, in offering up this devotion to Our Lady, I had done the first good prayer here ever. it's so funny, because on the one hand, he's being serious.
Yeah.
He's not saying it to be a troll. He's not saying he actually believes it. That woman who came to the priest and he's like, well, Miss Williams is awesome. You believe all doctrines. What's stopping you? She converts, right? And she's like, well, okay, because that clarity. And maybe if there was not that clarity, maybe if she comes to this priest and she's like, well, I believe all the Catholic doctrines. And the priest says to her, oh, well, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter. Just do your thing. Who cares? Just be you. Do whatever's good for you. And she's like, well, okay. I mean, I guess, right? And, you know, is that not such a microcosm of our problem today? Is no one is willing to put anything on the line of like, I believe A, B, or C. And these guys, they all did.
Yeah, there was a section they talked about commutative prayers. It was just, what, the guys would just get together and just pray. But like you said, if someone asked you a question about it, you weren't getting a milquetoast response. You were getting, no, here's a legit thing. There was a great chat. I've just flipped through it. I go, oh, there's what I was looking for. He talks about hearing the sturdy voice of many of our Catholic soldiers united in reciting the Rosary of Our Dear Lady in the adjacent tent. I cannot describe to you the effect that had on my mind. Almost all our Catholic soldiers approach the sacraments and carry them their prayer book, crucifix, and medal. What medal is he talking about? Medals were common, even among non-Catholics. A priest reported the soldiers, Catholic and Protestant alike, showed a great eagerness to obtain a medal of our Immaculate Mother, a chaplet. Only when furnished with a medal do they return to their regiments. Some of the Protestants who requested medals of the Blessed Virgin Mary were presumably like a Protestant minister duly once described, who, quote, looked upon devotion to the Blessed Mother as the most beautiful feature in the Catholic religion. Again, I didn't get that in high school.
Yeah. Do you not always hear, you know, every person who, a Protestant who converts to Catholicism, oh, you know, Our Lady was my biggest stumbling block. You know, Catholic devotion to Mary was the thing that, you know, I had to like, was the hardest pill to swallow. And here, a lot of these guys, maybe again, because this kind of like fearless faith witness of these priests who, like you said, if they were asked the question, answered directly, there was no confusion. They understood the honor, you know, due to the Immaculate Mother, and saw the beauty in that, where maybe today there's more kind of like, there's less clear answers about it. So you have the kind of awful misconceptions in Protestants who are like, oh, Catholics worship Mary or blah, blah, blah and stuff. And like back then, yeah, that was common. I found tons of quotes like that people that were coming towards Catholicism would say, and then I found like the devotion to Our Lady, something that strengthened my faith in Jesus and et cetera. And like these guys were all, it's funny to say, you know, old school. Cause I mean, it really is old school. It's 1860s. It's super old. You know, all these guys were incredibly learned, you know, obviously, you know, spoke multiple foreign languages, et cetera. Like a lot of them, the best of these bishops, of course, had, you know, done long stints in Rome. So I mean, these are very, very kind of philosophically adept people, like, you know, strong intellectuals, very much like in the mold of like what Aquinas is supposed to represent for the Catholic intellectual tradition. So it shouldn't be surprising that they're able to convey intellectually the beauty of the faith. But what was awesome was even people, Protestants who would describe themselves as unlettered, Protestants who are like, yeah, I'm just a country guy from the middle of nowhere, Georgia. and I dropped out of, or, you know, whatever, fifth grade education, because of the good kind of like catechesis, you could say, willingly and readily accepted the truths of the faith. And I mean, that was, I love the word you talked, you know, said before about that edifying. It was, that was very edifying researching this, like, wow, like consistently throughout the book, just speaking about the faith aspect, there seems to be a lot of clarity, a lot of beauty, a lot of kind of elevation of the spirit, and kind of throughout from all the characters.
Let's crank the edifying up just a touch. The second to last paragraph in the healing chapter, first sentence, Bannon concurred. 4 years of civil war has done more to advance the cause of Catholicity in the States, both North and South, than the 100 years that preceded. And the principal cause of this advance has been the charity shown by the religious sisters who tended the sick and wounded. He added that thousands of men who either knew nothing of the Catholic Church or only such lies concerning it were brought into intimate contact with its most energetic work in its most winning character. Talk about the religious system. How great was that chapter when you looked on that? I mean, there was the stories. Wow.
Yeah. No, like how do you answer this honestly without just being like, oh, they were so great. They were so great. You know, the kind of like the way that's so often done today, you know, where it's kind of like reflexively, oh, this person's the best. They're amazing. And that's being said because you feel like you have to or whatever. No, they were the real deal. Like this is, the sister nurses were the absolute real deal because they actually were the most politically disinterested. If you're talking about like an Augustinian distinction between the city of man, the city of God, the sister nurses were all about the city of God. They were all about, but like in those moments after the battle, the priests are about the soul, but beforehand they're firing cannons. The sister nurses never had a firing cannons moment. They're only about healing. They're only about, you know, restoring men to health physically, but most especially in the spiritual witness. And yeah, I mean, that chapter is just, I only included maybe like 20% of all the stories that I researched, but all of them basically had this template. So sister nurses, first of all, are medical professionals. It wasn't just like, oh, these nice nuns, how sweet of them. They were, you know, kind of the Florence Nightingale tradition, like we're very, very, however backwards medicine was then or whatever you want to say, and that, of course, too, is, you know, debatable. But whatever the state of medicine, they were trained near that high level, number one. So they were good medics. So a lot of guys come into contact with them because sister nurses are stationed at a field hospital or whatever. And the initial evangelical contact is, oh, they helped, you know, heal my leg. I didn't have to have my leg amputated. You know, they were good, you know, doctors, so to speak. But the sister nurses were like just magnets for questions. So I got my leg healed. Hey, you know, what order do you belong to? You know, what religion are you? A lot of these guys who were being healed were so ignorant. They had no idea they were even like Catholics. So like, well, one guy, hilarious story. He's like, a priest gets called in because he's going to, you know, baptize this guy and then, you know, bring him to the Catholic Church. And the guy's like, I don't want to be a Catholic. And the priest is like, the sisters told me you want to be Catholic. And he's like, no, I hate Catholics. And they're like, no, you said, they said that you want to be part of their religion. And he's like, I do. I hate Catholics. I want to join the sisters' church. And the priest is like, that is the Catholic Church. And then the guy's like, okay. Like, he takes like 2 seconds and he's like, well, I mean, they're walking the example. They're living like that Christ-like example. So if they're Catholics, I guess it's good enough for me. Because after being healed by these medical professionals, they would ask them the questions. And the sisters always kind of, you know, just incredible kind of like dignity and gentleness would catechize them, would explain, here's what the church believes, etc. And so I think they too were of the highest kind of intellectual caliber, that they had, you know, quote, all the answers, kind of this RCIA thing where they were able to answer the objections or whatever. But 100%, it was the imitation of Christ that was the most amazing thing, that they brought a lot of people to the faith just by people seeing in them, oh, this is what a follower of Christ looks like. And a final note I'll make too, they were horribly brave, horribly brave. Like, they were constantly under heavy fire. A lot of these field hospitals are, you know, right there on the battle lines. And almost like to a woman, they're like, well, look, I don't care if I die. I really don't care at all. Like, if I get hit by a shell and die, it's actually good. I'll go to heaven. Yeah. Kind of attitude. So they're just incredibly brave medical professionals, but kind of lived that example of Christ beautifully and had tons of conversions, you know, from that.
Yeah, the line that he mentioned before with that priest is great. He goes, I don't like that church a bit. I've never seen a Catholic, but I've heard a lot about them. The sister's church is the church for me. The man didn't believe Gosch when he told him the sister church was the Catholic Church. He asked the sisters if that was so. When they responded in the affirmative, one of the soldiers replied, "Well, I declare, I never suspected it. I have heard many things. I thought Catholics were the worst people on earth." The sisters hoped the longstanding opinion might change. The men agreed that it would, and later on, all became Catholics. And the next was that bonfire that five Protestants are standing around, and they're having a couple of drinks of Brazilian brew. And it wasn't long before someone added a stash of anti-Catholic seasoning. But then one of the five cried out for the discussion in immediately. "Stop, friends, stop. I don't know what Catholics are, what they believe, nor what they do. But since I was attended in my sickness by the Daughters of Charity in Richmond, I swore never to allow anyone to speak against their church in my presence. Please do not oblige me to go further to fulfill my oath."
I love that. Exactly. I love that this guy, I mean, talk about, you know, an impression they made on this guy. You know, he's a person who maybe he was not even anti-Catholic. Maybe he just was non-religious, whatever. But I don't even know much of his backstory. But just imagine, right? He encounters the sisters and they have such a profound impact on him. He swears like a binding oath. "I will like fight guy. I'll fight someone with like pistols at dawn duel if anyone insults the Catholic Church." He's not even, I don't know. I don't think he even was Catholic at that point. He just said like the guy went so hardcore that he's like, these people are such living saints. If anyone ever talks trash on them, it'd be like someone insulting my mom or my sister. Like I will fight them to the death, you know? So it's like that says it all. Exactly. It's hilarious and it's beautiful at the same time.
Oh, one more. Just because it's the Miraculous Medal, and I've had Catholics today get mad saying, "Don't give Miraculous Medals out to Protestants. That's like giving swine, food to the swine." And well, yeah, here's one back in the 1860s. A nurse from the Illinois Regiment was treating a Northern soldier from the Illinois Regiment when she noticed the medal of the Blessed Virgin draped around his neck. "Are you Catholic?" "No." Explaining that the medal was a gift from his girlfriend. He promised her that he would wear it. And while he was not initially a Catholic, he resolved to become one after returning home from the war. Sister Meyer and the soldier kept up a dialogue, and she found him a daily reader of a catechism, knowledgeable concerning Catholic doctrine. When later he became faint, the soldier told Sister Meyer he wished to be baptized into the faith. He was, and soon after writing to tell his girlfriend of his conversion, he died. I can imagine there's a ton more like that you found.
And like, yeah, and I'm with you. I feel like, you know, to have the attitude that, oh, well, you shouldn't talk to this guy or that guy or whatever. That doesn't, when I read the Gospels, you know, I'm always seeing Christ with the quote unquote worst people, right? You know, if you're a person today and you're like, oh, you're a Catholic, why are you talking to X? You're literally the Pharisee in the gospel, right? Who's like, oh, your teacher eats with tax collectors and sinners, you know? Yeah. It's like, and Christ so beautifully responds. I think it's Matthew 9:13 and 12:7, those two verses right there in St. Matthew's gospel. And he's like, you know, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. You know, go learn the meaning of these words. And I think these sister nurses embody this so beautifully. They're not like, oh, this guy's a Protestant. This guy's this guy's that. I heard this guy saying the F word a bunch. I heard this guy was a womanizer. I'm not going to associate with these like filthy people. No, they're like, you know, my Lord and Savior went and ate with the lowest of the low. And St. Paul himself, right, who says, "When I become all things to all men to save some." And I think like they live that. And I'm with those people. Yeah, I'm like, if the Protestant's like, hey, can I have a rosary? Like, take my rosary. Go for it, man. You know, like, who knows what that will do? And I always think like, keeping with that, you know, love God above all and your neighbor as yourself. If you're acting in that kind of caritas love type of way, like these sisters did, that's only good. That's only positive. You know, well, why would you kind of cut off that conduit of grace?
So after the war, how did it go after? I mean, did it become a, you know, hotbed of Catholicism afterwards? The cool off? How was the atmosphere afterwards?
Yeah, no. Did it become a hotbed of Catholicism? No. Number one. I love the South. I lived in Mississippi for 5 years. Just can't speak highly enough of it. All the kind of like, oh, Southern hospitality, the community. I'm an incorrigible football fan. I love football. So SEC football, all that kind of stuff. Like the South is amazing. I'm a huge fan of the South. And Catholicism in the South even 21st century now, you have like vibrant communities, but even to this day, right? I mean, it still holds true that Catholics are not, the South still is the Bible Belt, right? So no, it didn't become a hotbed. And I think actually Father Bannon was right when he talks about, you know, 4 years of civil war, those moments of great trial and stress, I think bring people to like the ultimate questions, the whole kind of like, there's no atheist in a foxhole, that kind of attitude. So I think in those moments, a lot of people who might normally be kind of lukewarm look towards Catholicism because, hey, all the chips are on the table, whatever. After the war and things cool down, I think a lot of people kind of go back to the default cultural Protestantism of just what the South is. You have pockets in these kind of like really, you know, famous, outstanding Catholic cities. Like you said, Charleston in New Orleans, Kentucky's very Catholic. But no, I think like Catholics remained an integral. The greatest American Catholic writers are Southerners, right? There is no question. I don't want to hear anything else. You know, I don't want to hear, I reject all arguments to the contrary. The two greatest Catholic writers of the 20th century are Walker Percy and Flannery O'Connor. And they're both Southerners, right? You know, Flannery O'Connor's from Georgia. You know, Walker Percy, I think, was actually born in Alabama. He has, you know, longstanding connection to the South. His most famous novel, Walker Percy's most famous novel, is The Moviegoer. And Binks Bowling, the protagonist there, is a guy in New Orleans. So, I mean, Catholics absolutely are like latticed over the South, and they still have a very strong cultural impact. One of my friends, not to get too far afield here, but one of my friends, his name is Alan Harrelson. He recently converted to Catholicism. And I actually learned about him converting to Catholicism because I watched him on Matt Frad's Pints with Aquinas. Him and I, yeah, you can look up, like, anyone who's interested, it's a very good interview, because Alan Harrelson does, he runs a YouTube channel called The Pipe Cottage about pipe smoking, and he's on that episode with Matt Frad, and I was shocked, I'm not even kidding, I was like, I could not believe it, that I saw him on there, because him and I were good friends as graduate students at Mississippi State, hadn't really kept in touch. And I see him on there, and like the headline is something like, "Oh, I just converted to Catholicism." I was shocked. It was beautiful. I was like, "This is amazing." But one of the things that he says, Alan Harrelson is a very, very Southern man. I think he's actually from South Carolina, and he talks about how in the Southern agrarian tradition, Southern literature, and he's a fantastic banjo player, by the way, too. Kind of Southern bluegrass music. In that whole Southern ethos, Catholicism is always present. It's always present. So, you know, this is a very long answer to your question, but like Catholicism remains present in the South. The Confederatization of the begins in during the Civil War, of Catholics being integral parts of this of the Southern nation, remains after the war. And Catholics are still a part of the Southern story. I think Nick Saban, the Alabama football coach, is a Catholic. Yeah. He donated a ton of money to
the chapel.
Yeah, which is amazing. God bless him. That's amazing. So Catholics are everywhere in the South. But to the second part of your question, no, it didn't change anything in terms of like, it wasn't now like, oh, the South flips from being the Bible Belt to being like, you know, Vatican City, you know, CSA or whatever. Like, no, I mean, it still remains very much dominantly Protestant to this very day.
Yeah, there was growth. Yeah, you put down the growth in it, the increase in numbers. But I remember looking up in South Carolina a couple of years ago, the growth was like this. And then obviously the 60s. Steady decrease. Yeah. It was South Carolina's number to the second least Catholic state in the Union. Mississippi, I think, is number one.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, we got a lot of work to do, but it's just still the stuff you wrote in there. I wonder if there, I hope it would help. But man, there was some great, beautiful stories in there. It, again, with the miraculous medal part, how many thought about that? If you're watching, how many thought the miraculous medal was given away during that war?
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, that's just not, and that kind of brings the conversation full circle to one of the earlier things that we talked about, that a historian, like, his whole joy, I think, in the profession is going to find the stuff that's buried over, uncovering the kind of hidden stuff. And it's like, if your entire Civil War education is simply, you know, Abraham Lincoln, Emancipation Proclamation, Daniel Day-Lewis movie, South are all bad guys, go Union, like just very simple soundbite stuff. I mean, you're never going to get to any of this kind of really rich, interesting, cool stuff. And so I just feel very humbled and honored. And I really, too, like I have a lot of credit, a lot of thanks to Allison Green, who is my dissertation advisor, because I really think her being a religious historian, I'm a cradle Catholic. I've always considered myself a devout Catholic. And I air quote that because it's like, you know, I think the better word is practicing Catholic. You know, devout almost seems like, you know, you're like, oh, I'm such a good Catholic. I'm so good. And, you know, God, I've been.
Hey, wipe that halo off. Shine that halo that's over your head real quick.
Totally. Yeah. Devout Catholic seems like, exactly. It's like, no, thank you. You know, I've been a practicing Catholic my whole life. God help me. I always will. And so I've always had, and I have a very Catholic lens to my life. I'm 100% Catholic. I'm both sides. And I said, again, my kind of ethnic heritage is Polish, you know, so that's, you know, all Catholicism, John Paul II, blah, blah, blah. So I always had religion on my mind. And in fact, like I said, again, my original dissertation was probably going to be John Paul II and his trip to the United States in 1979. But Alison Green, talking to her and realizing, oh, here's a historian who does religion as kind of her main thing. Like she does religion as the kind of driving lens of her historical analysis, got me thinking, oh, wow, like, I guess, why can't I do that for the Civil War? Why not? What's stopping me from saying, I'm a Catholic, I understand Catholicism as a practicing Catholic, so it won't be hard for me to get into the kind of the details, right, of the kind of stuff. Why don't I go and you know, go do that? And when you do, you go get down the road and you discover these kind of like beautiful stories. And I think that is very rewarding. It's very edifying to hear, like, here's these sister nurses and they're not spouting political slogans or whatever, or like, you know, fighting, and they're just helping people get closer to God. And there's just a ton of that in the book. Yeah.
Or even Stonewall, they mentioned that one of the priests said he was a man of great virtue and they prayed that he died with a perfect act of contrition, because obviously he wasn't Catholic, but they said he was just virtuous, really a virtuous man.
Yeah. 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 I always made a joke. I had the privilege of teaching a couple years ago, I'm trying to think 6 years ago, a class, oh no, almost 7 years ago now, but a class exclusively on the Civil War, which is kind of, that is my, if I was a medical doctor, you know, like, you know, foot and ankle or a cardiologist or whatever, like my historical specialty is 19th century America Civil War. And so I got to do a whole semester long class just on that. And so it was awesome. And I remember joking in that class about Stonewall Jackson that you'd want all of your generals to be Calvinists like he was. He's a Presbyterian. Because Stonewall Jackson, the guy was crazy in like the best way for a general. He would be sleeping on the battlefield and there's like shell fire exploding everywhere, right? And they're like, you know, General Jackson, you know, take cover, whatever. And he would like sleep through it. And they ask him about it. And he's like, listen, like God has marked out the exact second of my death. So it doesn't matter. Like whenever God wants me to die, nothing can change that. Whether I die, you know, in my bed or in the battlefield, I don't care. And it made him absolutely crazy and fearless in the battlefield. And of course, you know, the whole Civil War story, when Jackson's killed by friendly fire at Chancellorsville in May of 63, Lee, for the remainder of his life, will say, you know, if I had Jackson at Gettysburg, you know, it would have went differently. Jackson's whole famous kind of Shenandoah Valley campaign. And yeah, like not to get into a whole discussion with, you know, predestination and Calvinists. And I'm obviously 100% on the Catholic side of all that. And of course, the Catholic interpretation of St. Augustine, not the Presbyterian Calvinist one.
Right.
But Jackson, like, yeah, you can respect a lot about this guy. And a lot of it comes from his kind of from his Christian faith. And I think that's a great point by you, that like the priests were very no nonsense. We believe Catholicism is the truth. But they had tons of respect for Protestants. They had no problem telling them, I think you're wrong. I think you should convert to Catholicism. But with like Jackson, these guys, like, hey, there's a lot of beautiful stuff in your faith. And you know what? We're going to like, you know, we're going to hope for the salvation of all people. I hope he died in a state of grace. Let's pray for him. There's a lot of that kind of like, I would say, true Christian charity, which maybe is so lacking in our world today, right? Where it's like, this guy, I don't like this guy, you know, expletive, whatever, denounce this person. There wasn't a lot of. Yeah, it's kind of today it seems like it's the inverse. Today everyone acts nice to your face and talks all this trash behind your back, right? And oh, I'm a good person though. I'm a nice person because I'm very kind and sweet. But everything on Twitter or whatever, just like denouncements, polemics, profanities. Back then, people told it to your face, like, I think you're wrong and this is the truth. But in the kind of foundational in their heart, there was a lot of that true Christian love. And yeah, that was extended to all people indiscriminately.
So it's like probably going for another 2 hours talking about this with you, but just because it's getting late here, pitch your book. It's at Kent State University Press. It'll be at the show notes. Tell people they can get it where else.
Yeah. So yeah, total shout out to Kent State. I will say, honestly, I've heard a lot of authors, everyone's heard authors talk about their experience with publishing, whatever. I had a great experience with Kent State. If there's anyone who's listening to is like a historian person who's going to finish up a dissertation, like if you can get in with Kent State, they're awesome. They're great. So it's available on their website. It's available on Amazon. Yeah. And just kind of like for better or for worse, it's a Google search of Catholic Confederates. The main two places I'd say to buy it are like, you know, and maybe you're like, oh no, you know, Amazon, Walmart, the big box stores, you know, I want to support more local stuff. Well, then I would buy directly from Kent State. But also the book's actually done pretty well, which is cool. It's nice. Of course I say that, you know, shamelessly as an author, I want my book to sell well, but I've been happy for a history book that history books often, you know, no one cares, right? It's like three people in your field read this study you did of like 1909 Nebraska and like whatever, dude, you know, but I think there is some interest in this topic. The Civil War is perennially interesting for Americans. And so in addition to Kent State and Amazon, you can just get it like abebooks.com, like Lincoln. Is like a discount, like thrift books, whatever. I've seen a lot of kind of, you know, old used copies. People have bought it on there. Like you can find it just anywhere, just Googling it.
Yeah, everybody I sent it to wrote back. This is very interesting. I want to read it. Your YouTube channel. What can people find on there?
Okay, so yeah. I put a YouTube channel up in 2009. This is 14 years ago. And I just, put it up for the purpose of even just like my wife and I were living in the Czech Republic at that time, just kind of keeping in touch, whatever. I was not on YouTube whatsoever. Just kind of had the channel dormant. And then about 2 months ago, so to make a long story short, one of my positions, one of my jobs is this thing called Director of Intellectual Formation at the St. Augustine Center, which is on the campus of the University of Idaho, Moscow, Idaho, the Idaho Vandals, that school. And I can't speak highly enough of our pastor. He's the man, Father Chase Hasenroll. He's a legend. Like, I'm so honored to work for him and with him, but also like sincerely, you know, call him my friend, brother. He's a great guy. And you can find the kind of Vandal Catholic at vandalcatholic.com, St. Augustine Center. So I'm the director of intellectual formation there. And what I do is, to answer the question about the channel is, I do this talk once a month called the Hippo Lecture, which that book is actually coming out early December with Aruka Press in Toronto. And the Hippo Lectures, they're of course named that way for our patron, St. Augustine of Hippo, right? The Hippo Lectures are once a month, and they're often fiction pieces, kind of essays, cultural critiques. There's a playlist just dedicated to them. And the other thing of like import, I'd say to listeners who are interested in like Catholic Confederates, I teach a class at the St. Augustine Center, and it's called Maple Syrup History. And if you're like, well, what's up with maple syrup? That's a stupid name. I explain in some of those episodes, maple syrup is just my name for facts. Like, look, you know, in this class that you get normal history, maple syrup history is like extra maple syrup on the pancakes. Like it's not actually about maple syrup, but the place. Yeah, exactly. I've had some people be like, what's up with maple syrup? I just think it sounds cool, guys. That's always my answer. You know, like it's nothing to do with actual maple syrup. But the maple syrup history playlist is a lot of the classes that I've done at St. Augustine's, and there's maybe like 41 episodes on there now, I think. Our entire class from this fall is on there now. It was a class I did called Catholicism and Disasters. And if you scroll down through there, there's like we basically just did, you know, famous disasters in American history and the Catholic reaction to them. So I did a 5-hour episode on 9/11, did Chernobyl, Titanic, Hindenburg. And kind of your point, like a pitch for this playlist, the kind of why you should check it out, is it's a similar kind of surprising thing that you see in Catholic Confederates. When you're like, well, I didn't realize this was going on. Like, I don't know how many people know that at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there are Jesuit priests who survived the blast right in the epicenter, and they attribute it later to living the message of Fatima, praying the rosary, and St. Maximilian Kolbe of Auschwitz fame, right? You know, who dies in place of Franciszek Gujanovnik, and the guy who, you know, ends up surviving, dies in place of him. Maximilian Kolbe built the convent at Nagasaki, and that also survives the bombing. Mm-hmm. So like maple syrup history, especially Catholicism and disasters, if you go through that playlist, you will see the classes we do that we have, you know, at the center, and they're online. And it's basically just like, again, like the Catholic history or the normal history and the Catholic reaction. So yeah, check it out if you're interested. It's super fun. And the reason I made the point about like YouTube is for 14 years, like, I didn't do anything with the channel. In the last 2 months, I've been just uploading these videos. And it's been nice that, like, my channel is insanely small. It's not even, it's an understatement to call it small. It's smaller than small. It's completely unknown. But the people that have checked it out, it's been fun to have this kind of reaction of like, oh, cool. I can get the Catholic part of the Titanic. I didn't realize, like, these people were the priests and people praying as Titanic was sinking, whatever. And so if serving that kind of purpose, that makes me, you know, just super, super thrilled.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I checked out the Challenger one. I didn't know the teacher. I didn't know she was a Catholic lady.
Yeah, Crystal McAuliffe. Yeah, the teacher that won the Teacher in Space competition of that, you know, fateful, you know, space shuttle that explodes in 86. Yeah, she's the Catholic on board, right? Yeah, and it's like, again, like a lot of people too, if you're born in 1950, 60, 70, whatever, you might remember the Challenger. I watched it on TV. My aunt, she talks about how she saw it. You know, she was a teacher and they took a break and they're going to watch this. And like a lot of, you know, millions of Americans watched it live. But maybe before you've only heard about the Challenger disaster, you realize, well, this Catholic thing, that Catholic thing. So the whole maple syrup playlist thing is like getting deeper at the facts like Catholic Confederates does beyond simply the kind of just the history itself.
No, very cool. Again, all this will be underneath in the show notes. Dude, I appreciate your time being on. Again, thank you for doing it. Thanks for the research, the scholarship that went involved in this. Guys, got to check the book out. Again, it's underneath in the show notes. Maybe next time when your book comes out with Aruka, let me know and we'll do it again on that.
Hey, listen, it's an honor to be on your channel. I'll say it kind of right back at you. And we can get into this kind of compliment fest. But I'm serious. I've been a fan of Census Fidelium for 10 years. I always tell people, oh, you know, you got to check out this channel. You got to see this. I've been for a long time really enjoying it. Like you talked about Sunday, and it's like you're going to, you know, go to Mass and rest and do just step away from work. I've done many Sundays of just like scrolling through Census Fidelium, and I love your description where you're like, you'd be hard-pressed not to find it here. And I agree. Like of all your 9,000 videos, like there's always a topic to be found. So, no, it's a true honor for me to be on with you. Huge fan. Thank you for the invitation. 100%. When that book comes out, like I said, that'll be – out sometime this month. I'll send you a copy and I'll come on anytime you'll have me. So you know, thank you again.
No, you're very welcome. No, I joke with who did I tell that to the other day? Was it like Just for Hair, Just for Men commercial? No, we're just, was it Hair Club for Men? I'm not only the president, I'm a client. So trust me, everything, what everyone else gets out of it, trust me, I'm learning just as much, or I need to learn more, because everything that's up, I've had to listen to about 5 or 6 times. So I remember a priest saying, man, you've listened to my sermon more than anybody else in the world.
Well, hey, that honestly is just, praise God. That's the best. I mean, if you're doing something where, like you're saying, a lot of people are getting benefit, but you too, it's like, that is honestly, that's a dream, you know, having those two things happen at the same time.
Amen to that. Hopefully I don't screw it up for the salvation.